Official U.S. sources downplayed the loss of the manual. Not much made it into the public record, but a leak from a high-placed government source described the incident as a grave loss of national security information. Congressional calls for an accountability investigation followed. The dithering and recriminations and accusations were all part of a variegated deception, assembled and propagated via scores of unwitting sources and assorted blabbermouths, orchestrated by CI Chief Simon Benford, with the sole goal to reassure the Russians that the manual they had acquired was genuine. If an ancillary benefit was to protect the agent Diva, if she was still alive, all the better. SVR Directorates R, Analysis, and X, Science, submitted reports. Preliminary analysis of the U.S. National Communications Grid document passed by board concluded with the assessment that the document was authentic and unique. Directorate T officers, FAPC, communications experts and scientists from the St. Petersburg University of Information Technologies, began studying the manual in consultation with the Ministry of Defense to identify exploitable vulnerabilities in the vast U.S. network. Funding had been requested from the defense budget for developing software, cyber applications, and other tools for potential use against the assessed weakest spots in the system. Because they wanted to believe, a consensus was reached among the Kremlin Kinyatsky, the princelings. The material was authentic, a significant windfall, even if the Americans knew of its loss. Obtaining Bullard's information from under the nose of American intelligence was a tactical triumph, a demonstration of Russian mastery and tradecraft. That the volunteer Bullard had been arrested was his misfortune, obviously a result of his stupidity, sloppiness, and greed. The Kremlin couldn't care less about his fate. He was the Americans' concern now, for three consecutive life sentences. A commendation from the Duma recognized resident Volontov and the Helsinki residentura. In a late afternoon ceremony in the gilded Andreevsky Hall of the Grand Kremlin Palace, double eagles over the doors where red stars had once hung, SVR First Deputy Director Igorov was awarded a second star as Lieutenant General. President Putin himself handed Igorov the oblong felt box with the two star clusters, bussed him on three cheeks, and gave him a trademark crocodile smile that from the president was an exhilarating gesture of approval. The promotion ceremony coincided with the weekend and delayed Dominika's release by 2 days. On Monday, after breakfast, Vanya Igorov finally made the calls. To KR, to the Internal Investigations Directorate, ultimately to the FSIN, the creeps in the service for the execution of punishments, the demon offspring of the gulags. He identified himself using his new star, Lieutenant General Igorov, to tell them all to finish it up. It was beginning to look bad. She was his brother's daughter, for God's sake. No, he did not want them to go to level 2. No, he did not want to authorize administering drugs or a course of sensory deprivation or more severe electric shock. What the hell is wrong with you people? These measures are for bastard traitors like the mole still out there, he thought. If she hasn't confessed, there's nothing to confess. Though the devil knew what had happened in Helsinki with the Sleazniak, that garden slug Volontov running things. Clean her up and send her back to me. Her mother is worried. I want her back on the job, he said with fatherly concern. Colonel Dygtyar himself brought the cardboard box with her clothes to the cell, stood there while she undressed and returned the smock, state property, and dressed in front of him, her shins and thighs mottled blue-black, her fingernails purple, her ribs showing. They had accomplished all that in such a short time. They walked her upstairs to the grilled door, and she stepped out onto the snowy street with the traffic noise and the smell of exhaust from the buses, and she walked gingerly on the ice for a little way, just to feel the ground beneath her feet, her breath in clouds rising above her head. Her ballet limp was more pronounced now, and her foot throbbed, but she concentrated on swinging her arms and walking away from the walls with her back straight. The marks on her wrists were visible from under the cuffs of her overcoat. Dominika dreamed about prison in her bed, or sitting in a chair in the living room while her mother washed bedsheets, sour from the poison that was leaving her body. She backed into the hall closet and closed the door on herself and stood wedged in the dark to relive the cabinets, smell and sound, click, clack, and for the pleasure of knowing she could come out into the light whenever she liked. She wrapped her wrists together with pantyhose and strained the knot tight with her teeth to feel her pulses. After all the edgy urges left her, she cried silently, tears wetting her cheeks. Her mother played the violin every day now, a half hour at a time, while Dominica sat on the floor and stretched and lifted her legs until her stomach screamed, and pushed up from the floor until her arms shook. Her mother washed her, sitting in the tub the first night, but now Dominica stood in the bath alone, seeing the marks disappear, watching herself heal. She nodded to herself in the mirror. She was getting better, and with the feeling of redemption, the coda of a vermilion fugue, a red fury, repetitively welled up around her. It was a deep rage, one easily enough controlled, one that would last, one on which she could feed. Dominika Igorova sat in a chair in front of the paperless desk of her uncle in his office on the executive fourth floor of SVR headquarters in Yasenyevo. Outside, the snow-blasted pine forest stretched out of sight. Beyond them, the bare fields and the flat horizon. Sunlight streamed through the picture windows, illuminating half her uncle's face, but plunging the far side of it into shadow. Half his beastly yellow aura was mottled, the other half sparkled in the sunlight. Vanya Igorov sat back, lit a cigarette, and looked at his niece. She was dressed in a plain white shirt, buttoned at the neck, and a blue skirt. Her dark hair was carefully combed. She looked thinner and pale. "Dominika," Vanya said, as if she had just returned from a cruise on the Volga. "I was gratified to hear that the unpleasantness is over. The investigation of the Helsinki matter is concluded." "Yes," she said, staring at a point on the wall behind him. Vanya looked carefully at her. "You must not be concerned. Every officer who is active in operations will at some time in his or her career be involved in an investigation. It is the nature of our business." "Is it the nature of our business to be tied dripping wet in front of an air conditioner for 4 hours every day?" She said it calmly, without inflection. Vanya looked sourly at her. "Animals," he said. "I shall order a review." "A review of your own promotion prospects," thought Dominika. She nodded at a new plaque on the wall. "Congratulations, uncle, on your promotion," she said. Vanya looked at the citation and ribbon and fingered the rosette on his lapel. "Yes, thank you very much," said her uncle. "But what about you? What shall I do with you?" As if she were being given a choice, she thought, but she had something in mind. "Now that I have returned, I am ready to report wherever you wish to send me. It is your decision, of course, but with respect, I would very much not like to return to the Fifth. Would it be possible to resume the place offered me in the Americas Department by General Korchnoi?" "I will ask him," said Vanya. "I'm sure he would agree." "There's something else," Dominika said. She thought of them all and her prison cell and felt the tightening in her throat and knew her face and neck would be flushed. "Number 47. Infuse the neck and face to authenticate emotion or the advent of climax." Vanya waited. "I want to continue working on Nash," she said suddenly, holding his eyes in hers. Vanya sat back and looked thoughtfully at her. "Quite a request," said Vanya. "You know Colonel Volontov thought your progress against the American was too slow." "With respect, Colonel Volontov is a beast of burden," said Dominika. "He has no appreciation of an operation. He is doing nothing to further your interests or those of the service. Now that I'm away from his lecherous stares, I no longer care about his opinions." Vanya turned and looked out the plate glass window. "And what about Nash?" "I developed a close friendship with the American," said Dominika. "We saw each other frequently, just as you envisioned. Before I left Helsinki, we had become intimate."
"And you believe you could have determined his activities?"
He continued staring out the window, his yellow crown increasing in intensity. "He's going to agree," thought Dominika.
It's too important for him. Without a doubt, said Dominika. Despite Colonel Volontov's unhealthy interest, Nash's piltki, his ardor, was growing. Dominika did not take her eyes off her uncle. Unfortunately, prison and my interrogation somewhat derailed our romance. Vanya considered the whole idea. He desperately needed some action on the matter of the mole. His niece knew Nash better than anyone else did, and she certainly seemed motivated. But she was different in a way. The Lefortovo experience certainly had affected her. She seemed obsessed, driven now. Was she sweet on Nash? Did she want to spend more time outside Moscow in the West? Did she... Uncle, I was cleared, prompted Dominika softly, reading his thoughts. They told me I was reinstated. My record is clean. I'm the best officer, the best chance to engage the Americans and identify the Russian traitor. This operation is a challenge for me now. I want to go up against them again. You seem quite sure, said Vanya. I am, and you should be. It was you who created me, said Dominika. She saw how Vanya swelled up at that. His vanity was like a yellow balloon above his head. And how would you proceed? Asked Vanya. Dominika knew she had one thread to pull, gently. I would rely on your advice and guidance, and that of General Korchnoi. In this matter, General Korchnoi has not been briefed, said Vanya. I assumed that his department would be the logical place from which to work, said Dominika. If you have another idea. I will consider bringing Korchnoi in, said Vanya. The peppery uncle considering something he already has decided on, thought Dominika. Whatever you decide, we would keep it strictly rezzeldegni. I would clear operational steps directly with you or whomever you designate. You know Nash is concluding his assignment in Helsinki, said Vanya. He searched her face for a reaction, found nothing. I did not know, said Dominika. But it does not matter. There's nowhere he can hide. Gossip channels in Yasenyevo started humming. Word was out that Igorov's niece was back in the building, back from Finland. That was where the service just scored a big success, very hush-hush. Did Igorova have anything to do with that? Rumors about an investigation? The usual malfeasance or something else? She looked the same, but different, thinner. Something in the way she looked back at people, crazy, unblinking eyes. Now working in a private room in Korchnoi's America's department. Special job for the deputy director's niece, no surprise, but not just samisdienost. Not just the expected nepotism. Just look at those eyes, nutcracker eyes. Not the ballet. She had petitioned General Korchnoi asking his permission to join his department. He had paused and looked at her form under bushy white eyebrows, his purple mantle majestic. I commend you for your fortitude in Lefortovo, he said quietly. Dominika flushed. We will speak no more of that, said Korchnoi. That afternoon, Korchnoi had sat with the deputy director and sipped brandy and was briefed on Vanya's operation to reestablish the relationship between Dominika and the American in pursuit of the mole. Korchnoi showed he was impressed, asked Vanya to approve bringing Dominika to the America's department. It is the best place from which to work the problem, said Korchnoi. Volodya, Vanya said, the depth and length of their friendship apparent in his use of the affectionate diminutive. I need your imagination on this problem. I need something new. Between us, I will be surprised if we cannot come up with something, said Korchnoi. Vanya refilled their glasses. And strict secrecy on all this, he said, sipping cognac. We don't want to alert the mole to the noose tightening around his neck. She, Russian cabbage soup. Boil cubed beef, chopped onion, celery, shredded carrots, and whole garlic in water for 2 hours. In a separate pot, cover sauerkraut and heavy cream with boiling water and steep in a medium oven for 30 minutes. Boil cubed potatoes, celery root, and slivered mushrooms until soft. Combine all ingredients. Season liberally with salt, whole peppercorns, bay leaves, and marjoram and boil for 20 minutes. Cover pot with cloth, set in low oven to steep for 30 minutes. Serve with sour cream and dill. Chapter 22. Nathaniel Nash walked aimlessly down a light green corridor of CIA headquarters. The hallway was empty, stretching into the waxed floor distance of D corridor past where it transitioned into E corridor and the DI. To an operations officer passing through Directorate of Intelligence territory was like walking in a mysterious jungle. Heads would peer around corners and jerk back. Doors would open an inch and slam shut. A braying laugh, a howler monkey in the forest canopy, the booming notes from across the river of a hollow teak log being struck with sticks. Helsinki was a memory, a torment. Dominica had been swallowed up, disappeared, status unknown, welfare unknown, contact with agent broken. Wait till she comes out again, perhaps a station officer meets her at a dip party halfway around the world. Maybe in 10 years, maybe never. Or wait till another agent hears how she was sent to Lageria, the camps, or when the Moscow watchers read in Pravda how she died. The ongoing tap on Helsinki residentura communications revealed nothing of her fate. A month after Dominika's recall, Nate had asked Forsyth if he could go LWOP. He artlessly said he thought he'd travel to Moscow privately to see if he could find out what had happened to her. The usually unflappable Forsyth lost his temper. "You want to go to Moscow?" Forsyth raved. "An officer of the CIA with knowledge of Moscow operations wants to enter Russia as a private citizen without diplomatic immunity? A CIA officer the SVR knows was active in their capital committing espionage? Is that what you're telling me?" Nate did not reply. Gable, hearing the shouting, came into the office. "What's your plan, Nate?" said Forsyth. "Do you plan to storm the Lubyanka, blow her cell door, shoot your way up to the roof, and hang glide to the west?"
"It would be too far to hang glide from Moscow," said Gable. "Otherwise, it's a wicked good plan."
"I'm going to tell you this once," said Forsyth. "You do not have my permission or that of the Central Intelligence Agency to go on leave without pay, to leave this duty post, or even to remotely contemplate travel to the Russian Federation. We do not know whether Diva is in trouble, nor do we know her current location or status. We wait for word. We collect intelligence." Nate slumped in his chair. "If she's in trouble, we'll eventually hear," said Forsyth. "You are not responsible for this. You did not put a foot wrong. Diva was an agent. We protect agents. We run risks. We run them. The best ones we run against horrendous odds. And sometimes we lose them, despite all the tradecraft and all the precautions. Do you understand me?" Nate nodded.
"The long and short of it, Nate," said Gable later in his office, "is shut the fuck up. We have lots to do. Get to work, for Christ's sake. Stop mooning around. It's like a Jane Austen novel."
In headquarters, it made sense for Nate to be reassigned to CE-ROD, which stood for Central Eurasia Russian Ops Desk, the hot rods, the elephant's graveyard for officers returning from Moscow, still feeling the yips from constant surveillance. There were also officers who had swung and missed at a Russian in Malaysia or Pretoria or Caracas, and there were the first tour cherries who were in the pipeline for Moscow, all puffed up and serious, never having tasted the asshole-shrinking fear of having an agent's life depend on how well you used your mirrors. Chief Rod sat in his Langley office, a small corner space with a sealed double-paned window looking out onto the triple-vaulted roof of the cafeteria between the original and new headquarters buildings. C-Rod was in his 50s, a slight man with liver spots on his cheeks and thinning white hair combed across the top of his nearly bald head. A wiry white mustache and heavy-rimmed glasses gave him the look of a professor. The rack of pipes on his desk added to the fiction, for C-Rod was anything but a donnish academic. He was an old whore, with a dozen foreign assignments under his belt. He had made his bones working the Cuban target, and had shifted in mid-career to the Russian target when it was revealed that the entire stable of the CIA's Cuban agents, half 100 of them, recruited and handled and producing intelligence for 3 decades,
had, with two exceptions, been double agents controlled all along by the General Directorate of Intelligence in Havana. The revelation so demoralized a dozen veteran officers who had devoted their entire professional lives to Cuban operations that the DGI could not have destroyed the CIA's Cuban section any better if they had blown it up. Now, C-Rod was busy managing Russian cases around the world, running existing agents, a score of the best ones, solid producers. Marble was still the sine qua non of Rod's stable, but there were other potential acquisitions coming up, developing nicely. Every morning he would read the daily board, historically a 3-inch stack of printed telegrams, now a cascade of ops cables scrolling luminously down his screen from young officers and stations around the world about their developmentals. A global palette of events from Rio or Singapore or Istanbul, descriptions of contacts, budding friendships, drunken evenings spent knee-walking with Russian second secretaries or attachés or, most exhilarating, with suspected intelligence officers from the SVR or GRU. A recent cable made him remember. The young and convivial wife of a CIA case officer posted to a dusty African capital had shared her grandmother's recipe for fried cheese pancakes with the new bride of a quite formal GRU major. The women bonded as the young Russian wept over the platter of golden cakes. She was homesick and thinking of her own grandmother. "Feed her enough pancakes and he may flip," thought C-Rod. Against this backdrop, once or twice or five times a year, somewhere in the world there would be a recruitment. A human in a state of need would say da to the offer, whether gentle, oblique, fraternal, or simply a business proposition. And then cable traffic would increase as headquarters and the station in question plunged into the arcana of production, validation, tradecraft, and in a few delicious, exceptional cases, internal handling on the assets returned to Moscow. There were problems, as always. Recruitment targets lost their resolve in the light of a hangover dawn. Others could not, could never, summon the nerve to brave the wrath of their system. A few escaped the pitch simply by reporting the Americans' offer to their superiors to be hustled back to Moscow out of reach on the next available Aeroflot flight. And there was the dark side of the game, a reminder that the opposition was not always in defensive mode. The bombshell cable, one a year, sometimes a rash of them, reporting that a young CIA officer somewhere around the world was himself or herself the object of a Russian recruitment attempt, usually because the center was making a point or was trying to exploit a perceived vulnerability. The last flurry had come the year CIA salaries had been frozen by Congress, and the Russians were asking around, who needs money or who is disillusioned? To this world of ebb and flood, C-Rod had another immediate problem. He had been wondering how he could open the door to the zoo cage and get Nate Nash the hell out of the office and back to the field. The COVCOM message that came in last night provided the answer. C-Rod liked Nate, was thoroughly familiar with his record. He saw the inner fire, guessed at the emotional component, recognized firsthand the personal doubts of the thinking case officer. Doubts that colored successes and caused brooding over setbacks. He knew about the Diva case and how it colored Nash's days and nights. C-Rod stood and went to the door of his office, leaned against the jamb. Marty Gable would have bellowed for Nash. C-Rod was quieter than that. He waited till Nash caught his eye and gestured with his head to come see him. "Marble signaled," C-Rod said, putting a cold pipe into his mouth. "He's coming to New York, UNGA, for a couple of weeks." Nate sat up in the chair, a bird dog on point. "It's been some time since we've seen him. There'll be a lot to cover. You free right now to start prepping?" C-Rod was amused at the look on Nate's face. "Go introduce yourself to Simon Benford and CID before you go. He'll want you to cover the CI leads carefully, not to mention Marble's current security situation." Nate nodded and rose to leave the office. "Hold on," said C-Rod. "When you see Benford, don't say or do anything stupid, okay? Try really hard. I talked to him about this upcoming session with Marble. I'll quote him directly. Tell the case officer to scare me with his brilliance in managing these meetings with Marble.
Nate turned to look at him. You get the message?
Nate nodded again and left.
C-Rod saw his face had for the first time in months cleared.
Potato cheese pancakes. Coarsely grate onions and potatoes, drain and squeeze out absolutely all moisture. Add shredded Gruyere, flour, and pureed garlic to beaten eggs, then incorporate potatoes and onions to create a thick batter. Fry 3-inch rounds of batter in oil until golden brown, then flip and finish. Serve with dip of seasoned spinach, poached in heavy cream, and mixed with sour cream.
Chapter 23. Marble was too sensitive an asset to involve the station in New York. Rod bypassed the local New York COS, an ill-tempered, short-legged sycophant known exclusively for his ability to slap backs and cadge any sports ticket in town. He was excluded, clueless. Marble would meet Nate at night after his UN meetings concluded. Moscow, Helsinki, New York. They picked up where they left off. There was never time to get reacquainted with internal agents. You just began talking. Nate was sitting with Marble in a small Midtown East hotel suite. A desk, two chairs, the bedroom beyond, their coats thrown on the bed. It was nighttime, and the faint buzz of traffic from the FDR came up through the window. Two lamps were lit, and the men had drawn two chairs to the small table. Marble gripped Nate's hand affectionately. Nate poured a glass of water from a carafe with his free hand and offered it to Marble.
You look well, he said, priming the pump.
There was a tray on the sideboard with plates of sandwiches, a small salad, a container of vinaigrette. They had not touched the food. Marble smiled and shrugged. The work progresses, he said. In the center, we claim successes to please one another. We play the Mushanyava Vasnya, the mice games. Few of them are really worth the effort. He let go of Nate's hand, sat back, took a sip of water, and looked at his watch. I do not have more than a half hour tonight. I will probably be free in two more nights. There are some interesting developments, however, let me tell you, he said. I think Directorate S is running an illegal in the United States. He's being handled out of New York, but I think he is operating in New England because there are meetings in Boston. I am not supposed to know about the case, but they just started coming to me for advice on meeting locations. The case is well established. The illegal has been in place for some years. 5, I estimate.
Are there any other details to identify him? Asked Nate.
None. But there is something else that might be related. It is just a guess, said Marble. There is a new reporting stream that has begun. The GRU is very interested. Someone is inside your ballistic submarine program.
A new stream? What kind of information? What can you guess about the source?
It appears to be someone involved in maintenance. There's information about rebuilding the older boats, Trident class. Some information is very dense.
Dense? You mean detailed? Said Nate.
Yes. I have read a reporting summary. The source is inside the program by the look of it.
Marble took another sip of water.
But there's something strange. As chief of the Americas Department, I am unaware of any active source in my area providing military information. Judging by their interest, the GRU is not running the asset either. The information is new to them.
What does that tell you? Said Nate.
Marble ticked off the points on his fingers. There is a new stream of reporting. I myself am not aware of any registered source to explain this. An illegal exists. So I think perhaps this illegal, run by Directorate S, could be the submarine source, said Marble.
The reports just began, but you said it's likely the illegal has been in this country for 5 years, said Nate.
Precisely, said Marble. For 5 years he has been careful and built his legend, and he has finally developed access and has now begun actively reporting.
It would be the perfect combination. An invisible and well-placed mole who has eased into a position of importance, Marble said.
Nate nodded, writing in a small notebook.
What about the director's case you mentioned in Helsinki? Asked Nate. Is there any more on that?
Nothing. I know how important this could be, so I am listening and looking every day.
There is one thing that might be related. I was in the director's office one day, sitting at the back of the room. Igorov came in and told the director, there is something new from Lebed. He didn't know I had heard.
Swan? Asked Nate.
Yes, Lebed Swan.
The cryptonym for the mole.
Precisely, said Marble.
Anything else? Any other clues?
Just what I have told you. Swan must be very high up in someone's government to be run as a director's case. There are no indications anywhere in my department about such a case. No handling protocols, no operational cables.
What do you think? Asked Nate. What do you conclude?
Marble took another sip of water.
What I conclude, Dorogoy Drug, my dear friend, is that this wouldn't be a director's case if it were not in Washington, inside your government.
You think Swan's here?
Marble nodded.
How do we find him?
Marble shrugged.
I will redouble my efforts to identify him. In the meantime, you might look at the resident Golov in Washington. He would have the stature to meet someone senior, and he has a britva, as sharp as a razor on the street.
He got up and walked to the window to look out over the street.
So many games, he said to the city below. So many dangers. I will be glad to see an end to it.
As long as we're speaking of dangers, said Nate, what is your status? Are you secure? What are they doing to find their leak?
Nate avoided the word krot, mole, with all its connotations.
I will have to save that for our next meeting, said Marble, looking at his watch. There's nothing urgent, so it will keep.
Marble turned, walked to the bed, and put on his overcoat. Nate straightened the old man's twisted collar, patted him on the shoulder. They no longer had to worry about Mietka. Marble looked at him affectionately.
We can discuss the most fascinating subject, me, in 2 days. The conference ends at midday. We can have dinner and talk all night.
He looked out the window again.
I love this city. I would like to live here someday.
And someday you will, said Nate, thinking it was unlikely that Marble would be permitted to relocate here. It would depend on the nature of his retirement, specifically if he was alive to retire.
Marble walked to the door with his arm in Nate's arm.
Nate desperately wanted to ask whether Marble had heard something, anything, about Dominika. But he could not. Per the strict catechism of compartmentation, he had never told Marble about Dominika's recruitment, nor her mission to unmask the mole through Nate. Agents simply didn't know other agents. Instead, Nate said, we're hearing that Vanya Igorov recently was promoted.
Vanya is reckless, said Marble. I've known him for 20 years. He wants to run the service but does not have enough support yet in the Kremlin, with you-know-who. He needs an operational success to please the Oborotin, his werewolf master. If he does well with Swan, perhaps it will help him. But he needs something more, something dramatic.
Such as? Asked Nate.
To catch me, for instance, Marble laughed. I don't wish him luck.
Marble grasped Nate's hand warmly. Something was on his mind. Nate could sense it. Is there anything else?
I have a request, a message that I would like you to pass along, said Marble.
Of course, Nate said.
I would like to speak to Benford, if he has the time to come to New York in 2 days' time. I must discuss something with him.
Marble looked into Nate's eyes. Do you want me to pass him a message? Nate said.
Nate, I do not wish you to feel offended, but I must speak directly to Benford. Do you understand?
Marble searched Nate's face, but saw nothing other than affection and regard.
Of course I do, Uncle, said Nate. He will be here.
Marble opened the door. Nate saw the instinctive, undetectable beat as the old man checked the corridor.
Spokojnoj noći, said Marble.
Vispacha, said Nate. Sleep well.
A change of hotel at Benford's insistence, and Nate waiting in Bryant Park to pass Marble the room number. The basalt and gold battlements of the former headquarters of the American Radiator Company bathed in milky footlights against the city night glow. A bear hug at the door, it had been 4 or 5 years, and they sat, and the radiator rattled, and the Manhattan taxi horns came up from West 40th through the window glass. A bottle of brandy half full, and 2 glasses filled and refilled. They were not quite old friends, but Benford had followed Marble for 14 years. Once a year he had read the file, watching it expand, like a swimming pool filled from a garden hose, fat with contact reports describing the precious outside meetings each year, twice a year, in Paris or Jakarta or New Delhi. The Marble file was the well-thumbed chronicle in the 20 volumes of the life of an agent. A wife's death, a widower's sadness, the unexpected trips out to the West, the hurried arrangements to meet. CIA medals presented, 3 of them, and taken back, saved for a rainy day. Thank you notes from handlers and chiefs and directors, and the implausible certificates commending Marble for preserving democracy around the world. Problems over the years solved, big and small, and the deposits to the retirement account, the yellow flimsies bookmarking each 6-month chapter of the Odyssey. The file captured a chronology of CIA Russia division chiefs, some prodigious, some less so, who claimed Marble's successes as their own. It likewise documented a genealogy of CIA directors, some formerly admirals or generals, who unconcernedly wore their uniforms and ribbons among the spooks in the building that Alan Dulles built, and who carried Marble's occasionally stunning intelligence to the White House, presenting it as the unmistakable fruit of their tenancies. And the file listed the names of the young men and women, Marble's handlers, case officers of the snowy streets and the fly-blown lobbies and the ringing stairways, all moved on, some upward, some not. As was his custom, Benford had read the file annually over the years for the signs of tradecraft fissure, listening for the tapping of the Death Watch beetle in the woodwork. Cynically, Benford looked for signs of the turning, the flip, the fall-off in production, the photographic exposures more frequently out of focus or out of frame, the coincidental loss of access. There were no indications of trouble. Marble was the best Russian case in the CIA not only because he had survived so long, but also because he kept getting better.
"Nathaniel has told you what I have reported," asked Marble.
"Yes," said Benford. "We're going to be busy. The illegal, the submarine matter, the director's case, this swan."
"I read his summary this morning," said Benford.
"I'm sorry to say that the end of the Cold War has not diminished our leaders' inclinations to do mischief. In many ways, the old Soviets were easier to understand."
Marble poured 2 more glasses of brandy, lifted his glass, and sipped. Benford shrugged.
"We're probably just as bad. Besides, if we stopped, we'd all be out of a job."
"Which is what I want to talk to you about," said Marble.
"Volodya, are you telling me you want to stop?" said Benford. "Is there any reason for the timing?"
"Benford, do not misunderstand me. I do not want to quit. When it is time, I would very much like to retire calmly, to move to America, to let you buy me an apartment in this city.
You will have all that and more. Tell me what you're thinking.
How long I can continue working with you, and the precise nature of my retirement, whether voluntary or kinetic, remains to be seen," said Marble.
Benford thought he had never heard an agent refer to the possibility of his arrest and execution as a kinetic retirement.
Marble continued. "One thing is certain. I have 2 or 3 years left in the normal course of my career, given Vanya Igorov's aspirations and the general direction of the service."
"You could still become a deputy director," said Benford with conviction. "You're respected in Yasenyevo. You have friends in the Duma."
Marble took another sip of brandy.
"You would have me in harness for another 10 years, then, among the politicians?"
Benford, I thought we were zakadichnye drug, comrades.
No, my friend, my time is finite. And with some boasting, may I say that when I stop working, the intelligence will stop, and the loss will be felt.
Correct, said Benford. No false modesty need intrude. It will be a grave loss. You cannot be replaced.
And then will come the frantic cries of alarm from your masters, the calls to replace the intelligence, the wrong candidates considered, the rush to recruit.
A time-honored process, it keeps people like me young, said Benford.
Volodya, what are you driving at? I can hardly wait for what we call the payoff.
I propose to provide my successor, a replacement to continue the work.
Benford had seen too much over the years to be surprised, but he did lean closer.
Volodya, with respect, are you telling me you have a protege? Someone who knows the work we do together?
He thought briefly of the lead sentence of a CI memo documenting that.
No. She has no idea of our work together. This will come with time, when I train and prepare her.
Her? Said Benford. You propose to replace yourself, a general in the SVR with 30 years of experience and in charge of the Americas department, with a woman?
I do not object to the gender, but there are no senior women in the center. I am aware of only one woman ever sitting on the collegium in the last 30 years. There are junior officers, administrators, clerks, support staff. What kind of access will she have?
Calm yourself, Benford. Such a person exists.
Pray tell, said Benford.
Dominika Igorova, the niece of Vanya Igorov, said Marble.
You're not serious, said Benford, face dead, eyes unmoving, steady hands pouring another brandy.
Lightning thoughts one after the other in that wire snare mind.
Jesus H. Christ, she's alive. The two agents have met. They're working together. Please, God, they have not shared their respective secrets while eating borscht in the cafeteria. Young Nash is going to be busy. And finally, in a hot flash, this could fucking work.
Tell me why, said Benford with immense skepticism.
Please, Volodya, before the brandy runs out and I start to sober up.
Marble tapped the little table with his forefinger.
Benford, I want you to open your ears. This is a perfect conspiratia, an opportunity as good as you have ever had in the history of your service.
He tapped the table with each point he made.
She is the perfect solution to our problem. I have considered it carefully. Her last name gives her something of a pedigree, at least until Vanya retires or is purged. But by then she will be on her own way. She is a graduate of the Foreign Intelligence Academy, the AVR, and she graduated with honors. She is intelligent and has spirit.
Looking down, Benford turned the stem of the glass in his hand.
Marble knew what he was doing.
You and I know that a good record is not enough, continued Marble. She has the motivation, a mountain of resentment. Her father died, she was expelled from Dance Academy. Her Svinya uncle used her in the elimination of a Putin rival. He traded her silence for a slot at the academy, then broke his word and sent her to Sparrow School. You know what that is, I presume?
Benford nodded.
And then there was Helsinki. I assume you know she was there. Then an operational flap. Not her fault, but there was trouble, and they brought her back and sweated her for 2 months. In Lefortovo, can you imagine, like the old days? I can tell you she will not soon forgive them that.
I'm saving the best for last, said Marble, sitting back in his chair.
I know what you're thinking, that her career prospects as a woman are doubtful, that she is on the bottom rung of the ladder, that she will never, ever be able to develop any access. I propose to accelerate her career, to ensure her success, and she will never have to sit on a single general's lap, mine included.
I see, said Benford. And how will you accomplish this to catapult her to stardom?
Vanya Igorov is obsessed by the almost certain knowledge that there is a spy in the service.
Marble pointed to himself and laughed.
He in fact directed Igorova to Helsinki to get close to Nathaniel to generate some clue or a name about who the spy is. Did you know Nathaniel was targeted in Helsinki? Benford kept his face shut down. Marble continued. Vanya's plans have been delayed by her security investigation, but she is out and cleared, and frankly, this test of her, this Lefortovo episode, gives her more allure, more lusk, more luster. Only Russians can think like this, thought Benford. I've taken her into my department, said Marble, to give her a foundation. Vanya has informally asked me to reopen the operation using Dominika against Nate, and this will establish her as my close subordinate. We will choose our best moment, you and I, Benford, then make young Igorova a heroine, a star in the service, her career assured, from whom no advancement will be denied. The payoff, Volodya, said Benford. It's getting late. How are you going to make her a heroine? It's quite simple, said Marble. Dominika will discover I am the spy and turn me in. They wanted the noise and the people and the distance from the UN, away from the other Russians, in the village on West 4th Street. It was Marble's last night. The restaurant had a red canopy with steps down from the street and drawings of dancers on the walls and high-backed wooden booths that screened well and let them talk. Benford made Marble order pasta con le sarde, Palermo pungent with finocchio and saffron and raisins and pinoli, and they sat shoulder to shoulder at the table so they could hear each other. Benford was worked up, talked to Blue Streak, was even a little frightened. He had thought about it for 2 days from every angle, and it was monstrous, impossible, exorbitant. Things weren't that desperate. If they had to suffer a break in the intel stream, then so be it. It was the nature of things. But to contemplate giving yourself the chop simply to establish a successor, it cannot happen, he said. Marble said of course it could happen. It had to happen. If I am caught, who knows how the mole hunt will end? It all stops instantly, no retrieving anything. We cannot afford to let things fall apart, and if you doubt it, then think about the faceless illegal crawling around the inside of a submarine or whoever is Swan, reporting to Yasenyevo from Foggy Bottom or Capitol Hill or the White House. We can't afford to wait. And Benford, running out of room, said there was no guarantee that Dominika would even get the boost she needed, and Marble's gesture would have been wasted. To which Marble said, "Don't be a shutnik. Are you kidding? A young officer, a woman in the New Age Russian service, covetous for a place in the new millennium? With a counterintelligence coup like that, they'll make her a colonel overnight." Benford looked at Marble and ordered two more grappa. And Marble said, "Look, Benford, if I told you I have cancer and they give me a half year, would it make more sense to you?" And Benford said, "You have cancer?" And Marble said no. And Benford said, "Now who's being a shutnik?" Benford was down to his last card and said rather pathetically, "What about retiring to New York?" Marble smiled and said he never really expected he would. He really couldn't finish it like that, and put his hand on Benford's arm and said, "Let's play it forward a step at a time to see how it shapes up." And Benford, surrendering, said, "On one condition. We don't tell anyone, not even Nash, until we're sure." And Marble said, "Two conditions. We don't tell Igorova either." And they drank the grappa as the voices of the late-night crowd swirled around them, secure in their conspiracy.
Pasta con le sarde. In olive oil, sauté chopped onions, slivered fennel, saffron, golden raisins, and pine nuts. In the bottom of the same skillet, melt clean fillets of sardines and anchovies. Add a splash of white wine, season, cover, and simmer until flavors mingle. Toss with pasta of substance such as bucatini or percatelli. Chapter 24. Marble's reports about illegals and moles were restricted to a few senior managers in Rod. The real gerents of the information were the fussy introverts in the CIA's counterintelligence division, the cave dwellers of the 14-hour days in the wilderness of mirrors, the balmy men and women who at home had train sets in their basements and pruned bonsai trees. They began to read Nate's reports dissecting the information, starting the research. On his return from New York, Nate was summoned again to Benford's lair. CID occupied an entire floor of headquarters, a series of interior rooms bisected with hallways and warrens that, unlike the normal headquarters suites, were equipped not with the usual cubicles but with individual offices. All the doors were closed, each had a combination dial above the doorknob. There occasionally was a door without a knob, the keyway painted over. What were these rooms, and what did they contain? A bland secretary whose left eye twitched intermittently sat at a desk outside Benford's office. She looked at Nate carefully, blinked, got up, and knocked on the door, but did not open it. She listened carefully, then knocked again, gingerly. A voice from inside, and she opened the door a crack, uttered Nate's name, and stood aside, motioning for him to enter. Benford's office looked like the atelier of a dissolute professor at a forgotten Midwestern college. A torn and faded couch along the back wall was completely covered by stacks of files, some of which had fallen to the floor, where they lay fanned out like spilled poker chips. At the other end of the room, Benford's desk was a riot of overflowing inboxes stacked three high. A pile of newspapers leaned precariously on the opposite corner. On the walls were small framed photographs, grainy, black and white, not of wife, children, or relatives, but rather of bridges, tree stumps, wooded country lanes, and snowy alleyways between derelict warehouses. Nate realized that these were photographs of infamous sites, long ago signals, drops, and car pickups. Benford's children. Behind Benford's desk was a framed photograph of the neo-Baroque All-Russia Insurance Company building in Moscow, otherwise known as the Lubyanka. "Have a seat," said Benford, his voice gravelly and low. Benford was short and paunchy, with a high forehead and uncombed salt-and-pepper hair, a wing of which stood out from the side of his head. He looked at Nate with large, deep brown cow's eyes through long lashes that were nearly feminine. Jowly cheeks framed a small mouth that displayed in its constant ticks and frowns Benford's utter disgust, or at best his contemptuous dismissal of the matter at hand. "I read your final reports from New York," he said. "Grammar notwithstanding, they were satisfactory." "Thanks, I think," said Nate. He had carefully moved a few files and perched on the edge of the couch. "Do you like Marble?" asked Benford. "Do you trust him?" "I call him Uncle, if that's what you mean," said Nate. "We're close." "I ask whether you trust him," said Benford. "Yes, I trust him," said Nate. "He's been spying for us for 14 years. Benford's mouth turned down in impatience at being told something he already knew. "And do you think the nature of his new information, these clues and hints and traces about illegals and moles, is authentic?" "Seems like it to me," said Nate, instantly regretting it. Benford puffed his cheeks with annoyance. "Seems like it, or you believe it is?" Nate took a deep breath. "I think his information is authentic. If Marble were being fed a barium meal, the leads would be more distinct, more identifiable." Nate waited for the next series of frowns and pouts. Benford's head came up slowly. "Barium meal, indeed. Where did you hear that? Have you been reading history?" His gaze drifted to the far wall. "Do you know who that is?" he asked, pointing to a small black-and-white photograph of a square-jawed man in gig-lamp glasses, hair slicked close to his head. "That's Angleton, isn't it?" said Nate. "James Jesus to you," said Benford. For 10 years he thought every Soviet agent was a double. Every volunteer was dispatched, every piece of information was disinformation. He was charming and poisonous and paranoid and utterly convinced that his night sweats were reality. He might have been right. I keep his picture to remind me not to rebuild his asylum. Now, about Marble. I believe him, too." Nate nodded. His eyes drifted to the other side of the room, to a bookshelf overflowing with papers and books. 5 leather-bound volumes were unevenly stacked on the top shelf. Benford followed his gaze. "Those are the Wind in the Willows books, full of rats and moles." Benford stared at Nate for a few seconds, his face working. Whether in mounting distaste or in deep thought, it was impossible to tell. Nate kept his mouth shut, the only possible course of action. This misanthrope. 20 years of mole hunts, double traps, and triple crosses. Networks disrupted, attic radios silenced, spies arrested. Black and white newsreels of shrunken men being led out of courthouses with jackets over their heads, hands manacled at the waist. Benford's battlefield. He was clairvoyant, they said. A savant who relished the Byzantine world of deception and doubles and false trails. Nate took in the twitchy hands, long fingers running through his hair, the brain perhaps running too hot for its own good. Nate could see that Marble's recent report about moles and illegals was to Benford what a sack of rats was to a terrier. "I suspect he'll draft you to work with him," Searod had said. "Good luck with that." "I want you to work with me on Marble's information," Benford said. "Starting today. Move your belongings up from Rod. Don't tell anyone what you're doing. We're going to find the illegal." "Do I tell Searod?" asked Nate. "Should I tell him how to reach me?" "No one. I'll let him know if he asks, but he won't. We're not going to tell anyone about these leads. No Boston or New York station, no tight-ass FBI, no interior decorators and DIA, no NSC, no congressional committees. No fucking fuckers in Washington fuck starting this fiesta with their fucking leaks. It's just you, me. I trust that meets with your approval?" Nate nodded. Becoming Benford's acolyte is either a distinct honor or a prison sentence, thought Nate. But it didn't matter much. His career path after Helsinki had stalled. Benefactors like Forsythe and Gable were still in the field but unable to support him. Nate looked at the brilliant, twitchy Benford and decided. Nate was good at internal ops, he knew Russia, and he could contribute. Benford could hardly be viewed as a patron. Someone this misanthropic and sour would never be a willing mentor to anyone. But Nate decided to throw in with him, to immerse himself in counterintelligence, to learn about the fog-shrouded world in which Benford thrived. Maybe he could salvage his rep. In any case, for the first time since the farm, Nate stopped worrying about the future. Nate was quietly installed in a disused office in the corner of the counterintelligence division. It was utterly quiet in the hallway. Were people in there working, or would Norman Bates' mother's desiccated skeleton swivel grinning in her chair to greet you? "Here you are," said the secretary, giving him a wink. Or perhaps it was her twitch. "Ambiguous conundrums," Benford had said. "Get used to it." His new office was windowless, nude and stale. Pushpins dotted the walls. What must they have held up for display? A desk drawer that squealed when pulled open was filled with fingernail clippings, hundreds of them thinly covering the bottom of the drawer. The office next to his belonged to Alice, L-N-U, last name unknown. In her 40s or 50s or perhaps 60, she was square, with apple cheeks and fleshy nose, russet hair cut tight to her head and combed forward on the front and sides, like Napoleon's. She wore prison matron's shoes and walked splay-footed and fast. She spoke to Nate, as everyone else, by tilting her head and leaning forward, as if to share a confidence or a secret, which of course she never did. No one in CI ever did. In the first days, colleagues drifted by slyly to tell him that Alice was a plank owner in the division. "She's been here forever," they said. "She's the one who really killed Trotsky," they said. "She fucked Alan Pinkerton," they said, as they fled back to their offices. CID, the Island of Broken Toys. Nate checked behind his door for Boo Radley flattened against the wall. Benford had told Alice to help Nate. She had sat at her desk. Her office was actually sunny. A fern and geraniums flourished on a file cabinet.
her sensible shoes propped up and squeaking. "You don't know much," she had said. "Let's review. We have an illegal, we have submarines, we have New England, and we have meetings in Boston and New York." Marble mentioned submarine maintenance and fire.